It is really fundamentally an American.
Broadcasting from the Gulag city of Planet Earth, this is Cultural Baggage, the unvarnished truth about the drug war. My name is Dean Becker. Steve Nolan is our engineer. Today, the Drug Policy Alliance releases a report that summarizes the changes that voters and legislatures have taken in regards to drug policy reform. This is the executive chairman of the Drug Policy Alliance, Ethan Nadelman.
You know, there's a tendency for people to focus on Congress, and if Congress isn't doing something, to think that nothing's happening. But this report that we're releasing this week demonstrates that that a majority of the states have actually been passing various aspects of drug policy reform legislation since the mid-1990s, and that over 150 bills have become law around the country on subjects ranging from medical marijuana to treatment instead of incarceration, to repealing mandatory minimums, to improving access to clean needles to stop AIDS, to a whole range of other things. Congress is not going to move on this stuff. We're not going to see a national transformation in Washington until we see the transformation first happening in the states. This report shows that the transformation is beginning to happen in the states, and what we hope is that not just Congress, but that state legislators all around the country will get the message. If you want to base drug policy based upon science, concern for health, human rights, the Constitution, what have you, there's no way that you're going to be able to justify what Congress and what even most of the states have been doing. You look what happened in Texas, where a Republican governor signed a bill backed by people in both parties to provide treatment instead of incarceration for nonviolent drug offenders, very much like what passed in California with Prop 36 in 2000.
Would you tell my listeners where they can learn more about this report, where it is on the web?
Well, basically, go to our website, which is drugpolicy.org. I mean, you'll find the report called State of the State. Also, we hope that your listeners will sign on. There they can sign on to receive weekly emails and be brought up to date on the news, and also how to contact legislators when people either in their states or in Washington, D.C. are mobilizing for reform.
Thank you, Ethan. When you stop and think about it, the progress is really astounding. But the shaman that run the HHS and the DEA say that marijuana is a dangerous drug. Today we'll learn about a new exciting cannabis product called Sativex. It's made by GW Pharmaceuticals out of Great Britain, and it's going to be distributed by Bayer Pharmaceuticals. And our guest for the evening is the executive chairman of GW Pharmaceuticals in the UK.
Well, I'm Dr. Geoffrey Guy. I'm a pharmaceutical physician. That means I've spent about 23 years in clinical research in the pharmaceutical industry developing drugs. And I founded GW Pharmaceuticals right at the end of 1997 and early 1998. I founded the company really in response to a debate that was beginning to become more pressing in the UK during 1997. And that was namely that a number of patients were finding themselves in front of judges in court having used cannabis, marijuana, for certain debilitating conditions, mainly multiple sclerosis, spinal cord injury, and other neurological conditions. But the courts were taking pity on them and letting them off. And this presented a quandary to the British government and certainly the civil servants at the Home Office, because the law was being brought into disrepute. And therefore a solution was sought to find a way in which the patients could be treated, but with a legal prescription pharmaceutical. And I led that program and developed the plan, which was then accepted by the UK authorities and the UK government.
I understand that you have developed a couple of products under the brand name of Sativex.
Well, Sativex is one particular product, and that is a cannabis-based extract, which is made from the extract of two cannabis plants. The plants have been bred specifically to exhibit one or other of the major cannabinoids in abundance. So one plant exhibits very high levels of THC, and the other plant exhibits very high levels of CBD, which is cannabidiol. And we make extracts, pharmaceutical-grade extracts, from each of these plants, and then we blend them in certain ratios. And in the case of Sativex, the ratio is approximately 50-50, so that we have this equal quantity of THC and CBD in the material. And the reason we did this is this very much mimics the sort of cannabis that is found in Europe, derived from Northern Africa, for example, where the CBD content is typically much higher than the cannabis that would be found in the U.S., certainly 5 years ago.
You have done tests, you've done studies on these products. Could you tell my listeners what those studies have shown?
Well, first of all, the tests and research we do were initially to be able to grow the plants consistently, make consistent extracts, and produce pharmaceutical-grade material of appropriate quality. It would be pointless to proceed with safety and efficacy studies with an extracted material if it were to change each time we made it. So the early research was to ensure that we were able to produce a material which was highly consistent and of appropriate quality. We then went through a number of clinical trials which initially allowed us to establish the appropriate dose levels in patients, which would allow patients to gain relief from symptoms without necessarily suffering from any of the side effects of excess dosage. And this gave us a window, what we call a therapeutic window, for the patients to be able to treat themselves and maintain side effects at a very low level. Once we'd done that in a number of what are called phase two studies, exploratory clinical studies, we moved on into more advanced studies where we exposed a much larger number of patients, and now our trials are approaching over 1,000 patients in our trials overall. And in those trials, that four of which were completed at the end of last year, we were able to show the relief of symptoms in patients with multiple sclerosis, mainly neuropathic pain in multiple sclerosis, and that is nerve damage pain, spasticity, spasm, and in a wide number of patients, relief of sleep disturbance, which is very troubling to these patients. We also carried out studies in a very rare condition called brachial plexus avulsion, where the nerves feeding the arm are damaged during a trauma. Usually this occurs in young motorcyclists, almost exclusively males, and they are left with very, very painful arms. And we thought that this was a very good model to look at just how potent the cannabis extracts could be in treating this neurological type of pain, this neuropathic pain. And we were able to demonstrate benefit in these patients. And we also carried out studies in patients with pain of general neurological cause. And those would be patients with spinal cord injury, with peripheral neuropathies, and other neurological conditions, and were able to show benefit in those studies. What is notable is that in all of these studies, the patients were considered to be intractable, in other words, at the end of the road with regard to their therapeutic options. And indeed, during the clinical trials, the patients remained on all of their other medicines. These would include opiates, would include Neurontin, which is gabapentin, a product produced by Pfizer, and a range of other potent pharmaceutical products. And therefore, any benefit that we were able to show in those early studies was over and above these conventional treatments.
For the distribution of your products, I understand you've entered an agreement with the Bayer Pharmaceutical Company. Could you explain that arrangement for us?
Yes, indeed. We are a research and development company, and essentially our job stops once we have a product approved in a variety of countries throughout the world. We would continue to research our products to extend the initial indications, the initial conditions for which the product would be approved. But we commercialize our materials by entering into distribution arrangements with pharmaceutical companies that have established sales forces and established capability in selling and marketing pharmaceutical products. And during the course of this summer, we entered into arrangements with Bayer from Germany to cover our first product, Sativex, in the United Kingdom. And under that arrangement, Bayer will have an option to expand the territory from the United Kingdom to other countries throughout Europe, to Australia, New Zealand, and Canada. And we're currently in discussions with Bayer to consider which territories are most appropriate for them to be our distributor outside the UK.
I understand that just recently, within the past couple of weeks, that the Netherlands has now allowed for distribution of cannabis products through pharmacies, that Belgium is considering following suit, that we know now that Canada distributes medical marijuana to their patients. And I was wondering if you could give me your take on the situation in America. And I would consider the U.S. policy to just be stubborn and superstitious. Would you give us your opinion?
Well, obviously, I should be very careful and give my opinion on policies of different countries. First of all, I think we can comment on the Dutch and Canadian experience. I think the Dutch solution is a very Dutch solution and has really followed on from a series of liberalization measures that they have taken over a number of years. The patients are still requested and required to pay for these medicines, and the medicines have come in the form of herbal cannabis, which can be dispensed by the pharmacist. So the doctor in Holland, and indeed more appropriately in Canada, a lot of the doctors are not very happy that they do not have a product which has been tested rigorously in the way that every other medicine that they would prescribe has been tested. So they would have a situation where patients are taking a range of medicines because in complex conditions like multiple sclerosis or spinal cord injury or rheumatoid arthritis, for example, patients will be taking a range of medicines. All of these other medicines will have been tested to appropriate standards of quality, safety, and efficacy, but the doctor will not have or not be able to rely on those on that rigorous testing for this herbal material. I believe the Dutch have considered that this approach is an interim approach until pharmaceutical products are available. And certainly when one listens to the news from Canada, the Canadian Medical Association is not in favor of the doctors prescribing herbal material of unknown provenance. I understand that the major insurers that actually insure the doctors, for example, for malpractice, have indicated that they are not happy to be insuring such practice. And I think that these measures are interim measures, but demonstrate how carefully each of the countries have viewed this very, very difficult situation. The countries have dealt with these matters compassionately in their own way. We are in the business of developing pharmaceuticals, and a pharmaceutical is a worthwhile medicine that is able to yield profit to its shareholders so that we can put more money and resource back into research. And throughout Europe, I think the preferred route for the medical profession and for patients would be to be able to have a product prescribed, reimbursed either by the National Health Service or the equivalent reimbursing agencies throughout each country in Europe, and to know that it is of assured quality, safety, and efficacy. Now, the U.S. is very different in so much as the U.S. really hasn't embraced the debate with regard to the need that the patients have. And this has been very much an unmet need. It's been unmet by conventional pharmaceutical products and medicines. And that has been very well recognized in the United Kingdom, in Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and throughout Europe. And I think the U.S. is yet to embrace that concept that the patients have a very, very serious need, that they're being exposed to some very potent conventional pharmaceuticals, which are giving help, no doubt, in a number of cases, but also are accompanied by quite serious side effects. And when one considers the extracts or the components of the cannabis plant in comparison to some of these other very potent medicines, then the cannabis plant and its extracts provide a very favorable comparator in terms of fewer side effects and in terms of relative benefit. So one would hope that the lessons that are being learned elsewhere may well fall upon receptive ears in the U.S. in the years to come. But I, from my position, I can only see that this will be a rather slow and very resource-intensive process.
If you'd like to hear Dr. Guy's thoughts in regards to the use of vaporizers, please stay tuned.
This is Mark Greer, Executive Director of DrugSense. To end the drug war, visit MAPINC.org. That's MAPINC.org. Get active, stay aware, stay informed, and let's bring an end to this nonsense.
It's time to play Name That Drug by Its Side Effects. Abnormal dreams, confusion, coughing up blood, decreased sensitivity to stimulation, decreased sex drive, difficulty concentrating, difficulty speaking, hepatitis, impotence, memory loss, and sensitivity to light. Time's up. The answer, Claritin. You're listening to Cultural Baggage on Pacifica Radio, KPFT Houston. Now, back to our interview with Dr. Jeffrey Guy.
I recently received a couple of pictures of your production facility, and as I understand it, you have a very precise, very repeatable process to obtain the exact specifications for your products. Given that that is an exact process, that the component of each plant is repeatable, would it not be possible perhaps at some time to use those products with a vaporizer, perhaps to avoid the particulates of smoking?
You're talking about vaporizing herbal cannabis?
Yes, sir.
We have done a lot of research with vaporization, and a lot of our research is to do with vaporization of specific extracts of cannabis. It is very difficult to create a constant temperature through a vegetable and a damp vegetable material. As you know, dried cannabis will contain still a certain amount of water in it, and that the delivery efficiencies from vaporizing herbal cannabis are very variable. And whereas that may satisfy a vernacular use of the materials, one would not be able to satisfy the regulators in terms of product consistency, the consistency of the final material that is delivered to the patient. If you vaporize just herbal material, one would have to prepare the materials in a way that you get a very consistent substrate for vaporization, and then by adding energy in a predetermined fashion, and we do this in a computer-controlled fashion, then you will be able to produce vapor of all of the cannabis constituents in a reproducible and consistent fashion. In attempting to vaporize herbal cannabis, it is inevitable that carcinogens would still be released in hot spots within the material. And stopping hot spots within the material is very difficult to do. We've spent a lot of time looking at the heat dispersion throughout surfaces and surfaces that have cannabis on them. So in pharmaceutical terms, vaporizing a vegetable material is not a very satisfactory route to move ahead. However, vaporizing a consistent extract of that very same material, which will contain all of the same active components, probably would represent a very advantageous route for delivery of the materials.
I was wanting to ask you, in my past, I have grown plants here in Houston as tall as 26 feet, gotten as much as 4 pounds of prime bud from that plant. But I understand you guys have a more precise a means of doing this, whereby you keep the plants about a meter high. Would you discuss that the process of growing the plants?
Yes, obviously it's not my role to provide a grower's guide for marijuana, of course, and that's not why we do the research.
Yes, sir.
What we had to do is choose varieties of cannabis that would yield for us the correct components of the active ingredients, and we would stress that there are a range of active ingredients and they work best when they are in the right ratios as presented in the plant. We believe that the whole is greater than the sum of the parts, and a lot of our research is now able to show that. We have therefore bred plants and controlled the genetics through breeding. There's no genetic modification or modulation here. This is purely through breeding. In the old Mendelian sense, we have bred plants over many years. Now something like 15 years of breeding has gone into this program to produce plants with a very predefined amount of cannabinoid and a predefined cannabinoid ratio. Now that is one objective, but of course the plants have to be robust, they have to be pest resistant, disease resistant, and they also have to be open to economical growing. And to grow the plants economically, we wanted plants with short cycle to harvest. You mentioned a plant 26 feet tall, but I'm sure it didn't get there in 13 weeks. We want a plant that is not too sticky so that it can't be handled properly. We want a plant that provides a reasonable canopy to absorb the max amount of light, but not so much that there's increased humidity below the canopy so that we get an increase in botrytis, for example. And we've researched all of these elements over the last few years, last 5 years now. We've grown probably approaching 300,000 plants now. And we feel that we have an optimum approach which provides us with a very consistent end product, which can be subjected to economic growing at very, very large volumes now, and that we've been able to actually transfer that technology out of our own glass houses in the last 12 months to one of our contract growers, and the very first crop that they grew met all of our very rigorous specifications. So I think that what we've now done is been able to bring the varieties that we use in line with economic agricultural practice, and we're able to produce a very consistent end product.
You know, here in America, they talk about the harms of marijuana. They continue to, demonize it every chance they get. And I'm wondering, in your studies, have you had any instances where people wound up with kidney failure or liver damage from using your product?
Oh, no, certainly not. There's no basis for considering or even imagining that they would. There are no audited recorded deaths from the ingestion of cannabis alone in the last 100 years. The Journal of the American Medical Association in 1998 published the therapeutic index, which is the safety ratio of the materials, to be something like 20,000 times. That means one would need to take over 20,000 times the therapeutic dose before the product would kill you. Compare that to just a couple of dozen with products like morphine or paracetamol, which is acetaminophen in the U.S. These are, in pharmaceutical terms, very safe materials. They are of low organ toxicity. They're very well tolerated by humans. That has been witnessed by many, many thousand years of human coexistence and ingestion of these materials. So there's no basis, no reason to believe that that liver failure or renal failure would be a sequelae of taking these materials. And indeed, our clinical trials have borne that out. We have seen some side effects, which of course one would expect, and they are those that you would absolutely expect to see, and that is patients will have some feeling of intoxication. I must stress this is not patients being high or stoned. As we ask them to explore the appropriate dose, they will begin to get a prodrome of intoxication, which they very readily and easily recognize, and are able to curtail their dose to maintain their therapy below those levels. Patients also find that they have dry mouth, which is a very well-reported side effect of use of cannabinoids. We see some increase in heart rate in the very early days when the patients are first exposed to materials, which again is very well reported. And if patients do take too large a dose, sometimes we see a vasovagal or a fainting episode, but that's also been very rare indeed. The main side effects that we've seen in our clinical trials are those that could have been predicted from the vernacular or common use of the materials. And I think it is simply scurrilous to suggest that these materials would be the cause of liver failure or renal failure. There's really no supporting evidence in the science anywhere for that type of side effect.
In closing, I would like to address one other point. And my question, sir, is where would you send doctors, clinicians, and government officials to learn the truth about cannabis?
Oh, I think they could probably sit in their offices and read the appropriate text, which is now becoming available in the journals. It is very true to say that over the last 20 years, that most of the information on cannabis has populated the journals, having been supported by various agencies that probably have as their prime objective the highlighting of the dangerous aspects of cannabis. And I think that the literature, when you look at it over the last 20 years, is very much slanted towards looking for the side effects and looking for the dangers of the material. When one reviews that literature, and we have recently reviewed over 13,500 papers in the literature, you find that there is very little evidence or very little in the way of convincing evidence to say that these materials are harmful and damaging, but what one actually does find is that there is very good evidence in the literature to say that there is an exceedingly good basis as to why people in medical research should look at the use of these materials for a variety of different conditions. And I think that as more and more research like our own, and that supported by the British government in the Medicines Research Council research, and studies being done in Canada and elsewhere, as more of these studies are done, and people take a more pragmatic and sensible approach to cannabis and not demonize it and not have a paranoia about it, then I think the message will come through. If the doctors opinion leaders did want to find out a little bit more, then the International Cannabinoid Research Society meets once a year and has a 2 or 3 day meeting. Last year it was in Canada. Next year it's in Italy, and that is extremely instructive. There is a Journal of Cannabis Therapeutics which has some very good articles in it. I think the literature is now becoming well populated with a more balanced approach to this, and I think you'll find that hopefully US clinicians and US scientists will be able to look towards the European and perhaps the Canadian, Australian, New Zealand literature for the answers that they may seek. I think that we're close in the UK to or hopefully very close to be able to allow doctors to prescribe cannabis-based medicines sometime during the course of next year. We would certainly hope for that. We would hope to see our medicines going to Canada, Australia, and New Zealand very shortly after that, and then out throughout the rest of Europe. The challenge and the task in the US is a daunting one, but that hasn't put us off so far. And I would just say to your listeners that we would very much hope that following the successes that should come in UK and Europe, we would want to expand our program into the US so that US patients would be able to benefit from these medicines.
Thank you, Dr. Guy.
Well, thank you very much indeed, and thank you for your interest in this program.
Today, we are especially proud to present the award for Hero of the Week to Cheryl Miller.
I am Cheryl Miller. I have multiple sclerosis. I use medical marijuana.
Cheryl, one of our commandos in fighting against this eternal drug war, has passed on. A day of action is being called in her honor on September 22nd. Please visit CherylDCMemorial.org. Cheryl Miller, this week's Hero of the Week. Did you know cannabis is now legal in Ontario and British Columbia, Canada? Well, our guest next week will bring us the full story.
At the Hippie Cafe in London, Ontario, they're taking a bong hit out of the Crazy Homer bong.
Here's the Hippie Cafe. Hip hip hooray!
Just what do we have to fear? Next week's guest, Mark Emery. Now, here's an update on the Drug Truth Network. We have two new affiliates, KFAR in Knoxville, Tennessee, WVJW in Benwood, West Virginia. Now, that makes 8 stations in the U.S. and Canada. As always, I remind you that because of drug prohibition, you don't know what's in that bag, and so please, please be careful.
For the Drug Truth Network, and on behalf of my technical producer, Steve Nolan, this is Dean Becker for Cultural Baggage, the unvarnished truth. This show is produced at the Pacifica Studios of KPFT, Houston.